It's really hard to know where exactly to start because ever since I began to write my presentation, it's seen countless numbers of permutations, and even up until 10 minutes ago, it was metamorphosing. There is so much to say and so little time, and so you'll forgive me if I'm anecdotal at times and perhaps don't talk in great depth about the specifics of various pieces within the context of the projects that I had collaborated with Judith on. I suppose I'd like to start by asking the question, you know, what does it take these days to be a teacher or an artist or just a human being? And I can honestly say that I really don't know anymore. I don't know that I ever knew, but I honestly don't know. However, I just keep going. I can say that all I can say is that I'm really glad that I am an artist, despite wondering at times whether my life and time would have been better spent being a civil servant. I suppose I'd like to start a little bit and very briefly at Leeds University, where I was an undergraduate student under Griselda and Terry. And I'd like to start with a particular situation, because we've been talking about the museum as an institution, which of course is obviously and absolutely the site for a kind of discursive conversations. But nonetheless, for me, for my part, I see the museum as an extension of other kinds of institutions. And so I begin with the institution of education, and in this particular case, the University of Leeds in England. When I was in my final year of my undergraduate study, all of the students were being allocated a space in which to house their final degree shows, and I remember that the then head of department, some 20 years ago, Barry, I'm afraid I don't remember Barry's second name, came to see me in my studio space and then said, well, you know, we should go and see where we're going to put you in terms of, you know, your site for your final degree show. And it was the tiniest little attic room that probably didn't measure more than about 9 by 9 feet. And he said, well, this is your room. And I was so angry because there were a considerable number of spaces that I could have been allocated, and this was most definitely the most discreet and the smallest. And so I had sort of resigned myself at that point to make something, which in fact turned out to be a piece called Housewives with Steak Knives, that I knew would not fit in that space. And it didn't, and I got the space that I wanted. I guess that it's this kind of propensity for dissent that perhaps Judith recognized in me. And we first met in 1990 during a time that she was working with the Vancouver Art Gallery to bring a show over from England called Fabled Territories. The curator of which is here, Sunil Gupta. And what she had asked me at the time was if I was interested in collaborating with her at the Vancouver Art Gallery in working on a project. And it was, you know, obviously of interest to me. But I had been very clear in saying to Judith that what I didn't want to do most definitely was to parachute down and, you know, do something and then leave. So we agreed that for a period of about a year that she would send me a list of people, both artists and non-artists, from within the Vancouver community, with whom I began to correspond over the period of a year and to the run-up into the run-up to my residency at the Vancouver Art Gallery. It was a very interesting time for me, and I know I'm supposed to be talking about private thoughts, public moments, of which this is definitely one, but I'd like to address this particular exhibition because it was a fairly profound exhibition and, for me, a very meaningful collaboration. It was an incredible catalyst at the time in the Vancouver context, and I'd like, in many ways, to talk about it as briefly as I possibly can, because I think that there are some things that need setting straight. Judith showed enormous courage and veracity in seeing the project through with me, which of course helped and enabled me to see the project through. But she was at the receiving end of a great deal of flack at the time, which she really did bear the brunt of it from the non-white community within the Vancouver context. In particular, at the time, there was an organization called the Coalition for Color who were enraged at Vancouver Art Gallery's lack of engagement with artists from the local community, as it were, who were artists of color. And I suppose in many senses, this is the kind of almost the job of the municipal space, but they saw it as strange that, you know, the VAG should be importing products from across the waters and refusing to see what was there. And as it turned out, you know, after a year of corresponding with Judith and with various other people within the community, I arrived at a time which was really quite extraordinary because the Coalition for Colour were protesting and had organised, you know, the local TV stations to come and film or, you know, take footage of them demonstrating outside the Vancouver Art Gallery. And the long and short of it was that the project was nearly cancelled, but I refused to allow that to happen, and Judith was extraordinary in supporting me through that. I should start at this point with the images. Oh God. Okay. It sort of materialized, and perhaps in the context of the publication, the specifics of this will come out in different ways, but I'm going to be as brief as I possibly can. It materialized that a lot of, I had specified that I wanted to work with a group of women, and as it turned out, there were initially about 35 women of all different racial and cultural backgrounds and class backgrounds. The youngest was 22, and the oldest, Alfreda Schnedel, was 78. And one of the things, or one of the kind of points that had made the leading factions of the Coalition for Colour so angry, I think, was that it was very male-led. And they were very simply angry, I think, in my reading of it, that they as men could not and were not invited into this workshop situation. So we have to kind of deal with a very interesting set of dynamics. And despite that, and despite a lot of the kinds of, a lot of the issues that were really being debated and unpicked and resolved and discussed and perhaps not resolved at the time, we as a group of artists and non-artists and collaborators within the Vancouver Art Gallery had to really sort of keep our focus and insist on continuing and completing the project. Just, you know, being completely sort of resistant and refusing to be put off our track. The starting point for that particular project, it was a very difficult thing to arrive at in terms of trying to understand what the final nature of the project would be. So as a collaborative group, that's myself and all of the women that we eventually sort of came together to work as, we decided that we needed to decide for ourselves what it is, what it was at the time that we wanted to achieve. And I had tried to leave this very open, and what we finally decided was that in the past, the Vancouver Art Gallery had done various educational projects that they had relegated to the kind of educational space, which was and is problematic. And Judith was extremely supportive of myself and of us as a group in trying to work with us to get this housed in the main galleries, in the main contemporary galleries of the Vancouver Art Gallery, which had never ever happened before. And she was absolutely instrumental in that. Beyond that, what we had decided was that the most useful way of strategizing and trying to figure out what it was that we wanted to achieve in that short given space of time, which was just less than a month, was that the group wanted to take ownership of their exhibition. And it became a sort of blueprint for a project in the sense that eventually, we taught all of the members of the group how to write up a contract for an exhibition and how to get that exhibition, as it were, hired out to different venues, including the Vancouver Art Gallery. So the artists hired the exhibition out to the Vancouver Art Gallery. The exhibition was owned by the artists. And once the exhibition had happened in the context of the VAG, it then went on to travel right across Canada. And each time it traveled, in fact, one of the member group would travel with the exhibition and set up a very similar project in terms of working with various people within the community where the exhibition was then shown. So in many senses, I think that it was a very key project. But for me as an artist, it became quite difficult to know where to start in terms of bridging those things, you know, the aesthetic and, as it were, community practice, you know, how to make something that really stuck together and that was coherent visually, aesthetically, and intellectually, but at the same time, you know, working with very, very limited budget, sadly, and typically, but at the same time, doing something that was, I think, quite exciting. So we took as our starting point a piece that I had made previous to my going to Vancouver Art Gallery. It's called Infestations of the Aorta, Shrine to a Distant Relative, and it was a piece that was commissioned by the Photographers Gallery in London, I believe in 1988. Anyway, so this was our starting point and our maquette in some ways. Oh, I'm so sorry, I'm one of those people. I'm not one of those people. This was the group piece that we worked on to make. And as you can see, it took a very, very simple kind of structure, aesthetically or formally rather, in the sense that we used transparencies, and then each of us as artists had a given allocated space or dimension behind which we could each make something that was about our own personal memories and desires. I don't have the time to go into each work, so I'm going to, so forgive me for that, but these two pieces, the piece closest to me is a piece by Alexis Sato MacDonald, who is an Indigenous First Nation artist, and the piece on the far right was by a woman called Linda O'Hama, who was at the time a filmmaker. The piece closest to me is by Marianne Nicholson, and the furthest piece is by Anna Chang. I'm just going to flick through them because otherwise we're just going to run out of time. This closest to me on your left was my piece, which actually I had to make from a distance. I made in England and sent instructions, so it was printed on my behalf, and the little house was made for me through diagrams and instruction. I've got 3 minutes left, oh dear. Okay, this is a piece by Anna Chang. I'm going to really go through because I haven't even talked about private thoughts, public moments. I'm sorry, you're going to have to sit through some slides, and I'm going to have to be naughty and be a bit more longer than 3 minutes. Judith saw a work shortly after that project, and before I came to the AGO, she had seen some work, some site interventionist pieces that I had been doing over the years since 1990, and in particular, this was a work that I had done at the Pitt Rivers Museum. Again, in the context of Spring's presentation today about museum collection, I'd love to be able to elaborate on it, but we just don't have time, so we'll skip it. I don't have time to talk about this, but in 1994 I was invited by the Plug-In Art Gallery to make a piece which I called To Kill Two Birds with One Stone. And very briefly, it again involved collaborating with the art gallery and asking for donations from the community within Winnipeg, and it was a really very diverse community that responded for saris that they had. And it was an interesting tale because before I arrived at the Plug-In, I had a call from them saying, unfortunately, we haven't been very successful in getting hold of any saris. And I said, well, what have you been doing? They said, well, we've had an intern who was a male asking various people for saris. And I said, well, that's a little bit like a man asking for a woman to give them their underwear. You know, you just don't do that. So I had to get to Winnipeg and to meet with various people within the community who, because of course the sari carries the scent of the person who wears it or owns it, would and insisted that I met with them for lunch, for dinner, for tea. And, you know, I put on a great deal of weight, but I traveled in a taxi from one home to another and created a piece of work that was loosely based around the idea of the alphabet. And it was an absent performance. And basically what you had was two sides of the audience, many of whom were the people who'd loaned the saris, who just basically figured out there was each letter of the alphabet carried sections of the conversations I had had whilst having tea or supper or lunch or whatever. And so they began to look at each other and to really address the sense of who, you know, their neighbor was. I'm so sorry. I know I'm late. Please don't. Oh, shit. Okay. This is a piece that I made at University College. It's a piece that I installed opposite Jeremy Bentham, who presides over University College. And as part of his legacy, he insisted that for all Senate meetings, for all official meetings, that his preserved remains be wheeled into that meeting, and which is an extraordinary legacy to leave. And of course, because Bentham's other legacy was, of course, the Panopticon, which Foucault has written extensively about, I installed this projected image of a woman crying. It was a silent piece opposite his preserved remains, and or conserved remains. And as you can see, the image of the woman crying just about reflects roughly where his heart should be. That's Jake and Demas Chapman. But I'm very sorry, I don't know this particular woman. And there goes the politics of life. Okay. And so Judith then brought me over to the AGO to work with her. And as part of that project, I installed the crying woman, the silent crying woman, into one of the spaces at the AGO. More importantly, I was very privileged and delighted to be able to work with a number of artists from the Toronto community who were really at the beginning of their professional careers. Nina Arora, Asma Asha Mahmood, Rachel Carpenter-James, and Mira Sethi, all of whom created site-specific interventions within the context of the AGO. And again, it was a very elaborate and long and extremely rewarding process for me. It was very different to the Memory and Desire exhibition because what I had been very keen to do was to work with the artist in mentoring them, I suppose, in taking into consideration not only the kind of historical context of the museum collection, but also the kinds of formal and aesthetic and as well as the intellectual kind of considerations that are involved in the practice of the making of work. This is a piece by Mira Sethi, which responds very very eloquently and responded very eloquently to the educational sort of panels that are dotted about the Canadian collection area. In some ways, I'm sorry, I'm going over, I know, but I'd like to talk about this, if only just to open up the question of aspiration. This was a piece by Rachel, and Rachel's work was based in the room where the Group of Seven work is cited. And what I thought was extraordinary was her desire to respond to a painting by Forster, corrected by Mr. Bougereau, the portrait of Mrs. E. And by Varley, I beg your pardon, portrait of Mrs. E. in 1921. And what Rachel did, which I thought was absolutely fantastic, and again, I insisted with the AGO that I had a telephone budget because you can't just send email to people that you don't know very well. It was really wonderful that over the period of about, a number of months, that we talked about the content, what her aspirations for the work were, what she was trying to really establish. And I think that this was so exciting because what she did, essentially, was to create a fabulous piece of work that was cited in one of those drawers. And it really took the narrative, a fictional narrative, of a fictional narrative between Mrs. E. and the poet and Nobel laureate Rabindranath Tagore, who had visited British Columbia in 1929. And what she did in brief was to present something that elaborated on an aspect of relations between a man and a woman and across racial boundaries that I thought was very interesting and very exciting. She began to fictionalize a kind of diaristic correspondence between these two characters. And basically, it acted as a counterpoint to the remoteness of the social codes of behavior between men, between women and men at this particular period in history, but in particular, engaged with the plausibility and the possibilities of the sexual interaction across racial and cultural divides. In other words, her work addressed issues of desire, imagination. And perhaps I can just whiz through the rest of the slides, because I think maybe the idea of it, aspiration of desire is something that is quite central to some of the discussions that we are having in the context of the issues that Judith was trying to deal with. This is, I beg your pardon, I'm terrible at this. This is a piece by Asma Mahmood, and basically it was a response to the PEEP by Forster's drawing corrected by Mr. Bougereau. I know, which was a sound piece, and it incorporated the voice of her father, so every time you lift that wonderful veil, he kind of coughs. Okay. And, okay, sorry. I'm not going to say very much. The last piece is a work by Nina Aurora, and I'm afraid I've run out of time, so apologies, Nina. Okay, thank you very much.
I want to apologize for cutting the talk off, but since we have a number of speakers who have presentations, each of which runs 20 minutes for the last several, we're going to have to keep it very tight. And I am going to make sure that there will be time for discussions after in a minute, and then again after each speaker. So please bear with us, and I apologize for cutting you off. Okay.
We'll go fast. Can you hear me? What's going on? Okay, great. Thanks.